This podcast is brought to you in part by JFQ Lending. With interest rates below 3%, there has never been a better time to lock in a low fixed interest rate on your mortgage. You'll never need to think about refinancing again. Set it and forget it. And with JFQ Lending, you are guaranteed to get the highest level of customer service. They have an A+ rating with the Better Business Bureau and over 3,000 five-star reviews. Give Jared Ritter a call today at 480-637-7979 or email Jared directly at jritter@jfqlending.com. JFQ Lending Incorporated, Equal Access Lender, licensed in over 40 states, www.jfqlending.com.
Notre Dame football and 60 minutes of hell.
It would be Lou Samoji, because I know Lou would do a great job with the special teams.
I don't know. Every time I'm out on the field, I just want to just be dominant.
One thing we always say is we need to dominate the obvious situation.
I'm just back in Notre Dame. Oh, picks.
Man.
The Irish to win.
Yeah. I just feel thankful to be in the ACC, be able to be playing, obviously.
And it still doesn't mean I can't have a Mai Tai in July on the beach. So I'm not lying.
You can cross one more off the list, a particular list for Notre Dame. Lou, do you know which one that is?
One less Notre Dame fan, Phil Jakovic.
By the way, our message board was going, yeah, you'd certainly think so, that it was about Phil Jakovic. But no, in fact, relating to the actual game Notre Dame played, Notre Dame entered that with having played but never beaten five teams currently in the FBS. It's now four after the Irish dismantled and undressed South Florida on Saturday. The Bulls were one of the five. Do you know who the other four are? Okay, who am I kidding? Yes, you do. Who are they?
Well, it's stunning that three of them occurred in consecutive years. UConn at Notre Dame Stadium in 2009 in Brian Kelly's final year. UConn is not even playing football this year and may drop down to the FCS level soon. So I don't know if Notre Dame can ever even that up again. Then in Brian Kelly's first year in 2010, it was the University of Tulsa, a game that was marked down as a sure win and resulted in a 28-27 defeat. And then the following year, of course, was the opener against a USF team that finished 5-7 that year under Skip Holtz. So you had three in a row there. And then previous to that, you had a traditional Pac-12 bottom feeder in Oregon State, but they were very, very good when they defeated Notre Dame in the 2001 Fiesta Bowl 41-9 and also in the 2004 Insight.com Bowl. But that's another team you would never figure. How the heck is Notre Dame behind in this series? The one legitimate one is Georgia, against whom Notre Dame is 0-3. Lost the 1981 Sugar Bowl. That was Georgia's only national title. And despite Notre Dame outgaining them by 200 yards. And then a couple of heartbreakers in 2017 and 19.
What do you think would happen if I went on insight.com right now? I wonder what that early 2000s bull sponsor exists, if it does at all, or what you'd find on that domain if it's still a thing for some bull that's probably changed names, I don't know, 10 times at this point. But anyway, yeah, there are actually three other teams that Notre Dame has played but never beaten in like the entire history of the program, but they're not in the FBS. So it's the University of Chicago, hasn't played major college football since 1939. Yale obviously still plays during the FCS, but they've been in the FCS for 40 years. And get ready for it. 1895, Indianapolis Artillery.
A team that was loaded.
Swish. Yes, and in one of Notre Dame's first years in playing football, they played a literal army. Like not a service academy like Army West Point that has cadets that will go into the army, but a literal army. Like just and like when we're talking about how the sport and even the Brian Kelly era has changed, or the early 2000s Notre Dame football has changed with know, think about those three straight years where they're losing bye games at home. How even from there had progressed to, yeah, you could play literal armies. Like, I wonder if, like, Indianapolis artillery still exists, or if there's any commemoration of, hey, we have the win percentage that's against Notre Dame that's tied for the best win percentage anyone can boast against Notre Dame, right? I'm curious if anyone out there has done some digging on that and what exactly Indianapolis artillery is. I'd be curious. Literally, I think it could be just, you know, some bunch of guys as part of some infantry that just decided to play Notre Dame in football. Yeah, who knows? But yeah, this is, you know, we think about scheduling now where all these games are in, you know, 20 years set in advance, or even right now in the opposite, you know, 5 days in advance in this football in the age of coronavirus. Yeah, you just rolled up in scheduled armies. Yeah. But anyway, Notre Dame defeated South Florida 52-0. And it's one of those where the box score just still doesn't quite do it justice for how quickly it became, you know, over. Let's dive into that for a minute. But the best way to support this podcast, the Irish Huddle, is to subscribe to blueandgold.com. If wherever you're listening, please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. Or if you're watching on YouTube, smash that thumbs up button and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can follow us on Twitter at Patrick Engel, E-N-G-E-L. Or you can follow Lou at BGI underscore Lou Somogyi, S-O-M-O-G-Y-I. So yeah, that 52-0 score, like, it still just doesn't quite convey how fast this game was just not competitive, and really how it was not competitive from the start. I mean, USF had one first down in the entire first half, and it was that, you know, 40-plus yard run that they broke off in the second possession of the game, I think. I mean, they had problems snapping the ball to their punter. They had 15 passing yards at halftime. Like, it's just a collective woof. So, Charlie West Jr., long road ahead to make that thing where he wants to get it.
Yeah. Well, the encouraging thing there is, for so many years, and we just alluded at the start of the program to these kind of games, Connecticut in 2009, Tulsa in 2010, although Tulsa won 11 games that year, and South Florida in 2011, there's still sometimes that fear factor, that trepidation about, oh, any given day, something could happen. I just never had that sense going even into the game with South Florida, and then certainly once the game started, that was going to be the case. And sometimes we just take for granted the last 3 years how Notre Dame has established itself as a top 10 caliber program. And when you do that in these type of games, this is what you expect. There was today in Brian Kelly's conference, he was asked about USA Network broadcasting his speech at halftime about just put it on their throats and no let up, no more Mr. Nice Guy, etc. Just keep the, you know, pressing down on the pedal. And Brian Kelly said, you know, if I knew that was going to be in there and recorded, I would have articulated it in a different way. I feel the same way. Last week, I was a little hesitant. These first three games, and I am not trying to diss the opponent or anything like that, these are scrimmages for Notre Dame. That's the purpose of these three games. And it's not always going to be pretty, because you're kind of trying to establish an identity. And sometimes you have to force feed it. Sometimes you have to find your way along as far as how you're going to operate. And it's not always going to look pretty. So it's not necessarily just about stats, but how you establish an identity and build from week to week here. Wake Forest is a beautifully coached team, just like Duke is, for what they have. I mean, there is no comparison to the level of talent that those schools recruit in football to what Notre Dame does. So this is, I've always referred to this, this is one of the most favorable schedules I've ever seen in 50 years of following Notre Dame. And this is the type of example I'm talking about. that's not to say, and it's not disrespecting. It's just the reality. Just like Brian Kelly says, it's the reality when he spoke that way in the locker room without trying to be disrespectful. We respect all opponents, but the reality is there's no comparison in talent level. Wake Forest is going to have a potential first round pick in Carlos Basham at defensive end, but Notre Dame has about five or six defensive ends who could play in the NFL someday. So that's what I'm referring to. So you use this time as an opportunity to really forge your identity for the long haul ahead.
You just gave Dave Clawson some bulletin board material if he's listening to this podcast. Shouts to you, Dave, if you are one of your GAs. Yeah, no, of course not.
Fantastic coach. He's done a beautiful job wherever he has gone. I mean, I've seen a lot of people mention him as a potential, you know, Notre Dame candidate. I think he'll be too old by 2024 or 25, you know, whenever Brian Kelly steps down. But fantastic coach. But, you know, look, Wake Forest knows it too. You know, as far as – and they'll be inspired by that. Certainly they will be. But, you know, they knew just like with Clemson in the opener that there's going to be a talent disparity.
And going back to his halftime speech, I don't really think it was – even like I understand why he, you know, came out and clarified today, Monday, or yesterday, Tuesday, if you're listening to this on Tuesday, that, yeah, we don't mean any disrespect. I don't think, you know, certainly Jeff Scott would think so, considering he coached for Dabo Swinney, who has his guys in that mindset all the time, right? And it really is like, don't let up, go finish the job. These are just things you always want your team to have. And I don't think there's anything wrong at all with, you know, trying to hammer that home as much as you possibly can. And I'm just kind of surprised that he was like, yeah, just didn't come out and say, yeah, sorry that got caught on a mic. I don't regret any of it. I'm sure that's kind of what he's thinking to an extent. And if I were him in that spot, I would be too. But
yeah, it takes great guts and courage to be out there in a college football field, whether you're South Florida, Duke, Wake Forest, and you have nothing but respect for those guys out there, especially many times when they know they might be outmatched and that, you know, there won't always be glory on the field out there. So it's all great respect to them as who they are as men and the courage that they show. I'm just pointing out that, look, with these first three games, this is a great, great opportunity for Notre Dame to be able to use these as, you know, work to put themselves into that championship mode in November and hopefully December. And if all things go ideally, maybe even January.
So they played to get back on the on-ramp here for a minute, they played the game, of course, and it was pretty clear what they wanted to try to do here. And that was just run it at them, run it down their throat, make them stop it. And South Florida just didn't. I mean, Notre Dame ran for 281 yards, 6.2 yards per carry on 45 carries. Really, it was not anything USF really ever had a even little stretch where it could stop Notre Dame's running game. And maybe until there was a drive there when the backups came in where I think Notre Dame went three and out. The first time, and then maybe one first down and out or three and out again. I can't remember exactly. But either way, like, you had three running backs, or your three main running backs, now that, you know, they apparently Sebo Flemister is in that conversation, at least to help out. You got, you know, team high 13 carries. Yeah, I know some of those were in garbage time, but he was still in there in the first half. Each of them, Flemister, Chris Tyree, Kyron Williams, averaged over 6 yards a carry. Offensive line, I know this is always going to be a group that, you know, there's consternation around, and every, you know, 1 yard gain is going to get people all fired up to, you know, fire Jeff Quinn for the 10,000th time. But they did exactly what you want to do in these types of games, which is just like you alluded to, Lou. It's, you can go into this and just think, they're just not going to lose this game or even really put a much have much stress involved in it. Like it, and I wrote the that was my main takeaway in the column I wrote off the game, and you can read that on blueandgold.com if you haven't already. Is that you probably just didn't have any fears about this going a wayward way, even for a minute. And if it was, I don't know, 10-7 late in the second quarter, I would have been, I would be very skeptical if anyone who had in, let's say that hypothetical situation is in implied for a minute, says, yeah, they're actually going to lose this game. Like, no. And even I would say the same thing against like Duke. Do you ever think they were going to lose that game, even though, yeah, Duke was competitive. They certainly got Notre Dame out of some things they wanted to do and revealed some things that Notre Dame is still working through. And I'll probably say the same thing against Wake Forest the following week, unless, all right, this is, you know, you got first and goal in the, you know, inside the 5-yard line or something and 30 seconds left and yeah, they can walk it off. But I'll be surprised if it gets there until later on. And again, no matter what happens or if it's a close thing for a half or 2+ quarters or whatever. Anyway, you much rather see them, you know, handle business in the way that they did, especially running the ball when that was so much of a, you know, a question heading into the year than, you know, struggle to it.
Yeah. Liam Eikenberg, a lot the Tuesday before the game, he talked about how, you know, we have got to be able to use that outside zone play as kind of the bread and butter, the main staple, and then have some derivatives come off that, whether it's the mid zone running, the play action passing off of it, etc. And that's where I refer to as this was a perfect opportunity in a scrimmage-like situation to function and to be able to execute those plays. Now they have some film work. Okay, this is the way to do it. Now, the competition is going to be stiffer as we go on to the season. Pitt has a very, very good defense. Florida State has some big-time talent on their defense as well. Clemson, from what I understand, is pretty darn good on there as well. Boston College is always going to be physical. So you're kind of just working now to, you know, iron out some of the flaws and warts. And this presented the opportunity. Look, in this game, you know, Ian Book, if they wanted to, he could have flung it 30, 35 times, completed 25 or 30 for about 400 yards and 5 touchdowns. And it's like, hey, Ian Book for Heisman and all that. That's not what this is about. The identity of this team is going to be predicated more on the physicality, the running game, the tight ends, where they came out with a 3-tight-end formation again and utilize it. But just because you come out with that doesn't mean that you're just going to operate that way. They threw 3 passes right off the at the start of the game, including on the first play, a 24-yard completion to Tommy Tremble to kind of just loosen it up and then go from there. So I liked how, even though that is the point of emphasis, it's not inflexible enough where they just want to force feed running the ball. It's like we have to be able to operate on different cylinders and be able to balance it out and not just be one-dimensional there. So the South Florida game presented a perfect opportunity to do that, and they took advantage of it. You know, the passing stats, 13-19, 148 yards, no touchdowns, that's not going to raise eyebrows for anybody, but that's not what the game was intended to be. Book threw for 88 yards in the first quarter and 56 for the rest of the game before being taken out late in the third quarter. So they established that, okay, we can wing it if we want, but off that they were able to then really work on what they want the identity of the team to be this year, which is centered on a strong running attack.
And we saw them go in some of those, you know, tags and variances in the running game. You know, after and outside of that outside zone, there were some, you know, some runs with pulls, lead blockers. Obviously, Tommy Tremble as the lead blocker in a lot of those where he was the highlight, at least on the broadcast. And here's one way of at least illustrating. Yeah, you can feel good about overall where the rushing operation is as a whole. On the short yardage spots where Notre Dame really struggled last year, like didn't quite average, you know, 2/3 of those third down, fourth down, and short situations on run plays, converting those. So far this year, they're 12 of 15 in third downs and fourth downs with three or fewer yards to go when they run the ball. And even that, they haven't even tried to pass it in one of those situations. And yeah, I mean, you can, the first reaction is, well, let's do it against Clemson and whatever. And yeah, of course, that's what matters. But I don't think you can discard this, especially when you consider when Notre Dame played New Mexico last year with this very same offensive line, they were 5-9 in those situations. That's fewer than less than 60% against another bad team, right? And again, it's a lot of the same players doing this. And yeah, that's encouraging. And then you even see how the running backs can kind of complement that in a way where they have guys who can make defenders miss and cut up field. You saw Chris Tyree on a couple of his most explosive runs. And I know this is South Florida, but still, I think this point especially remains where on two of Tyree's biggest runs, he looked in his cutback lane and saw an unblocked defender and a guy who was looked in both times, supposed to be unblocked. It was a linebacker or somebody in the second level who had read the play where it was going outside before it cut it up. And Tyree saw that, saw the blocks were where they're supposed to be otherwise, cut right at the guy and made him miss both times. You probably don't see that as much last year. And of course, you saw Kyren Williams break a lot of tackles in that opener and just evade contact and keep going after contact. And then Sibo Flemister too. He obviously isn't quite the speed threat or maybe the receiving threat that either of those guys are, or quite as explosive, but I think he can add something as a one cut and go, get up the field. He kind of almost rampages it more than he runs it. And you like the toughness. I mean, Brian Kelly told us on Monday that their defensive guys do not like tackling him. He's well built. So I think you can at least be encouraged, if not, you know, indicative of, all right, this should be a running game that can show up against, you know, a lot of the teams that are going to be on the schedule again. Well, no, this game didn't tell us really anything. That, oh yeah, Notre Dame is on that national title contender level, you know, whatever. It wasn't going to, no matter what happened in it. But you at least saw a lot of the things in it that you would see from a team that proves itself to be one in, you know, later games against better teams that show up on the schedule.
We often use the acronym YAC, yards after catch, for wide receivers. Well, the yards after contact is another YAC that can be talked about. And I think that's one of the things that's been kind of a pleasant surprise with the running backs so far is the yards after contact that they've displayed. You saw it last week and this week too with Kyren Williams and Chris Tyree. These guys, and including Sibo Flemister as well, there isn't any – when you think of physical power games, sometimes you think of that 230-240-pound Jerome Bettis type back who just pounds and pounds and wears down a defense. And that's not what this Notre Dame offense really is built around. Some of it has Tommy Tremble lined up in the backfield as a classic fullback at 248 and as the lead isolation blocker. But what you do have is some good hard-nosed tough running from guys in that 190 to 200 pound range that I mentioned with Williams and Tyree and Flemister. They don't just go down on that first hit. You know, sometimes they will on a really good hit, but they've demonstrated a capacity to keep moving forward with the pile. So I think that's been kind of emblematic of the physicality that the program overall wants to instill this year, just like they did in 2017 when you had Mike McGlinchey and Quentin Nelson on the left side, and then, you know, a couple of veterans like Sam Mustipher and Alex Bars also there. You didn't really have necessarily a great passing quarterback in Brandon Wimbush, but a great athlete who could also, you know, hurt you badly with his legs. It's like, you know what? This is who we are. This is where we're going to be. This, they established it early, and they finished seventh in the country in rushing yards per game at 269.5. This team is not going to be at that level because I think they're able to pass it better and hopefully do so more than they have demonstrated in the first 2 weeks. But it's something I could see them, you know, being in that 210, 220 yard range rushing. Similar to what they did in 2015 when you had guys like Josh Adams and CJ Procise in the backfield, and also pretty much an all-pro NFL offensive line blocking for them with McClinchy, Nelson, Stanley, Nick Martin, even Steve Elmo, who, you know, left football after 3 years, but they've been able to formulate around their strengths, and I think that's what they're doing this year as well.
So here's a Pro Football Focus stat for you to back up exactly what you just said. In two games already this year, Tyron Williams has 13 averted tackles, is what they'll call it. Jafar Armstrong had 15 all of last year. Josh Adams in that 2017 season had 44, which is good. So, obviously, on the way to outpace that, though, Kyron is, if he continues on anything like that. I mean, okay, 13 of those in two games against, you know, still inferior competition is probably unsustainable. But nonetheless, it's turning into what was a question mark or a something that lowered the ceiling for Notre Dame's running game last year into a strength of being able to make guys miss and make an offensive line look that much better. Because, all right, if there's one guy that's not blocked, or one guy they can't get to, or one guy who makes the right read or shoots the gap and beats a blocker or whatever, you have a better chance of just making that guy miss and the play is not automatically blown dead. And Williams is averaging he's at 3.4 yards after contact on average, like every time he's been contacted. That's a lot lower than Adams, who was at just under 5. Chris Tyree at 5.86, probably, again, unsustainable. That's really hard to do and can be influenced by a few long runs. But, again, it looks like something that this collection of Notre Dame running backs can do really well, and that will, you know, you think about the being realistic that they can get to 200-plus rushing yards a game, or at least threaten that landmark somewhere.
I'm fascinated by how people keep these stats like 5.86 yards after initial contact. I mean, just scrutinizing it that closely, it kind of reminds me almost like the Elias Sports Bureau for baseball. They have stats from 1896 or whatever about how a team does when it in the ninth inning when two runners are on and, you know, the moon is full or the sun is out or whatever. And some of these stats today are amazing.
Yeah, we're not in the era of Notre Dame playing a literal army anymore. It's come a long way from the numbers they didn't have then. Although I think it's funny you mentioned Elias Sports Bureau. I think there was a first, and it was credited to Elias for finding this out. Not that Falcons fans need another tough reminder of how hard their life can be sometimes, but they were the first team to lose where they scored 39 points, had no turnovers, and there might have been one other thing in there. As far back as that data went, no team had ever lost when they no turnovers, 39 points. Maybe there was some yardage mark, but yeah, tough scene. But we saw a real, you know, willingness to just load up and just move USF off the line of scrimmage with a lot of the personnel groupings that Notre Dame used. We heard Brian Kelly talk about in August that they're going to see 13 personnel and it won't be just in goal line yet. Well, they started three tight ends against South Florida. They were in 11 personnel one more snap than they were in 13. And if you add up the 14 personnel times in the, on the goal line, that's still only a goal line thing at this point, with 14 being four tight ends. They were in it more than they were 11, which is, you know, the three receivers. And the slot receivers were barely involved in this game at all. Of course, Lawrence Keyes being unavailable certainly contributed a little bit to that. It was only Avery Davis, but even then, he wasn't in on the first couple of drives. 41 snaps for Notre Dame in 12 personnel with two tight ends. That really looks to be a base thing and something that they do really well, with both catching the ball with the two tight ends they can put out there in Tommy Tremble and Michael Meyer. I think we saw, and even last year, of course, what Tremble can do. And in the opener, how Meyer just looks different with the ball in his hands and how he can create after the catch. And some of those numbers in those personnel groupings are even kind of skewed a little bit, where, okay, technically it's 13 or it's 12, but they would motion in Javon McKinley, the receiver, and have him line up right near the end of that line by the other inline tight ends. And it would be, you know, he's basically a tight end out there. So you'd have, okay, 13 personnel is basically 14, and they're running his way because he's a good blocker too, or 12 becomes 13. Just kind of an interesting little inside baseball way of just how much they really committed to do this and try to, you know, account for everybody out there and just open up these big holes that the running backs had to run through all game.
You know, it's kind of funny, Patrick, when Tommy Reese replaced Chip Long as the offense coordinator last December, you know, I think there may have been some initial thoughts of, well, Chip Long was the tight ends coach as well, and the tight ends were very, very productive during his three seasons at Notre Dame. And, you know, Chip had been previously a tight end himself, coached the position, and he really emphasized it very heavily. And now you're thinking, you know, now you're making the transition to a former Notre Dame quarterback who holds a lot of passing record. It's like, okay, this is going to be a pass-happy operation, loves to throw the ball, et cetera. And it's been quite the opposite, really. The tight ends are emphasized just as much, if not even more, under Reese right now. And that's like I said, this has been the common theme through this show so far, is you want to establish a certain identity. And through these first two games, I think it's pretty clear what direction they want to head into. And then you use September to try to establish that. And then in October is a time, I think, maybe those offshoots and derivatives especially with a bye week on October 3, now you have the opportunity to hone in on other things as offshoots from the outside zone, the midline zone. And I'm specifically referring to the passing game that in October, I think we'll see the offense evolve a little bit more after you get that first bread and butter established, as you have in the first 2 weeks.
So I'm going to go out and make just this bold prediction right now. Last year, Notre Dame's tight ends caught 63 passes. They're going to match that, if not top it. I know, maybe even one fewer game. Yeah, and that has a lot to do with what's going on at receiver and all that. But it's just kind of hard to deny that right now those are some of their best receivers. And just in a vacuum, they're good receivers. Like, who doesn't want to throw the ball to Michael Meyer? Or Tremble. You saw the play action and the deep threat that he can be there. Of course, you saw it in the snippets last year backing up Cole Kmet. So, yeah, they are going to match that 63 catches from last year. And for the point of reference of, okay, is that 63 a lot? I think it's the most. Maybe I'm missing the 2014 year in there. Most since 2011, when Tyler Eifert caught 63 passes by himself, which obviously is on another level. But
and overall, they caught 66 that year, I believe.
Okay.
63 of them were by Tyler Eifert, correct.
And it won't be as lopsided, you know, when, if you're asking me, they do that there. So it'll be split because you've got two good receivers, and it looks like right now that's just going to be something that's here to stay. And that second tight end will be out there a lot, working in that slot receiver and, you know, maybe taking away snaps in a sense from the slot receiver spot. So Let's dive in more to that passing operation. But first, a word from our sponsors. Yesterday's Restaurant in Granger is a full-service restaurant serving some of the best food you will ever taste. At Yesterday's Restaurant, the philosophy is simple. Life is short, eat well. They believe that every meal should be a special occasion. That's why at Yesterday's, they serve only the finest organic and locally grown produced vegetables, fruits, dairy, meats, and fish. They hand-make most of their delicious meals from scratch using only the finest ingredients available. Everything they serve is fresh and guaranteed delicious, and the recipes are unique and original. From prime rib, fresh fish, to the award-winning Great Scott Burger, rated by ZZ Zippy as the number one hamburger in a 100-mile radius, you are sure to delight your taste buds. Yesterday's makes their desserts from scratch, fresh every day, including their world-famous Corbett cheesecake. Let the staff who love what they do make your Yesterday's restaurant experience outstanding. Visit us online at yesterdays-granger.com or book your reservation on OpenTable or by calling 574-272-7017. Looking for that unique Notre Dame item for the Irish fan in your life? Visit Augie's Locker Room, the country's number one Notre Dame memorabilia shop. They have the largest selection of Notre Dame helmets dating all the way back to the turn of the century up until the present day, including the Shamrock Series helmet. They also have stadium benches, frame tickets, one-of-a-kind Rockne items, signed items, and many other unique pieces. If it is ND, they have what you are looking for. Visit them online at augieslockerroom.com or call 574-277-NDND. That's augieslockerroom.com. So like you alluded to earlier, Lou, Notre Dame didn't try to throw it a lot. Again, Ian Book, 12 of 19 for 144, had a couple of 20-yarders, which didn't really have in the opening week. Didn't try to, but still kind of coming out of this with some questions of, it just doesn't seem to be there yet or something reliable that if you had to ask them right now, all right, go win the game. We got to throw. We don't have time. I'm not sure how confident you can feel or even really how confident the staff would feel that they can actually go mount that drive. And again, this is the first two games have at least continued to establish that you've got some good tight ends in your rotation as passing options. Tommy Tremble had 3 catches, 60 yards. That led all Notre Dame receivers. But if I didn't think it was possible for the receiver production to get lower than it did against Duke, which was 7 catches, 74 yards. The wide receivers caught 4 passes for 41 yards. And yeah, of course, part of that's a little bit of usage, but for every one, you just kind of saw disjointedness. And like Kelly and Book had alluded to after the first game, there's missed reps and missed things that you didn't have in spring practice that'll hurt. Although with every passing game and every passing practice week, that becomes a little bit less of an excuse or a crutch, where at some point it's got to catch up. And I don't know when it will first hurt them or even make life like, all right, we had to get some kind of fluke thing or a blown coverage to score this late touchdown to get the win or put away a game or anything. I'm not sure when that game will be.
It'll be next week. I think October is when I anticipate, especially after do you have a bye week as well, in order to do the self-scouting and recognize, okay, teams are going to load up because that's what Notre Dame is going to emphasize. That's the same thing in 2017. What answer can you counter with? And I think that's going to be something that will be looked at and probably executed more in October, also with an opportunity to get extra reps in practice with a Braden Lindsey, with a Javon McKinley, with a Joe Wilkins, and then Ben Skoranek coming back from his hamstring injury. And hey, a guy named Kevin Austin hopefully can also be incorporated into the mix as well. along with an Avery Davis, or, you know, who knows, you use a Jafar Armstrong or others for the tunnel screens. But eventually, when the level of competition picks up in November, you're going to have an answer for, okay, how are we going to play against this type of defense that's going to load up inside? And, you know, one of the original answers against South Florida was, we're coming out passing right away. It's not like we need to force it and we're going to jam it down your throat and we're going to go 5-on-7 blocking or anything like that. Sometimes we can just wing it when we want to, when you're not expecting it, let's put it that way. But it's going to be when the opponents do crowd that line of scrimmage, can people go deep? Can the protection be there to give Ian the time? Will Ian have the patience in the pocket to be able to go through his progressions and find the open man? And that takes chemistry, time, and reps in practices. And that's why it wasn't anything I was expecting necessarily this month, but I think in October is when you want to start really seeing that development in that area of the game.
And the question really is, all right, how long can it go on like this? And it's kind of two parts, where how long can you get away with it? Yeah, like you said, probably somewhere in October where, all right, they'll try to slow down your running game, but is anyone going to be able to do it? South Florida certainly wasn't. I'm at least not sure that Wake Forest, and who gave up 45 points to a pretty suspect NC State offense last week, at least suspect as of a year ago, or what we saw last year with some of the same guys now back.
Yeah, they finished 107th in scoring here at 22-1, and they doubled that.
And there's the second part, really, is how long should you try to do something about it in games instead of just having a QB who's, I'm going to use Brian Kelly's words in here, managing the game. And Kelly was quick to preface that with, we don't think he's a manager, but he's managed it really well. This was kind of something that rose my eyebrows a minute when he told us this after the game. And it was, all right, I think it was correct just based on what we've seen the first two games. But yeah, he's not a game manager, and especially you saw that in the later half of the 2019 season and in some early moments in that 2018 as well, where how long do you try to just not even get anything going with that and just continue to run it and don't stop it? And of course, like, you're not going to go away from what's working well. You want to put the game away, as Kelly just emphasized in that halftime speech, but it's something that you still just want to, that you want to see. And that, yes, even though you hammered it down USF's throat and to an extent Duke's for two games, and they didn't do anything to really slow you down and force you to, all right, we gotta chuck it around here. You want to just be able to at least see the ability to, especially in a game like this, and we haven't really seen it yet. Like, Notre Dame needs Book to win, and it will probably need him to win those bigger games in November, like you said. And it won't be every game where you have your offensive line and your tight end just driving guys into the sidelines, or as Jarrett Patterson did on a quarterback sneak touchdown, 4 yards back of the line of scrimmage. Like, it's not going to happen every time. And I'm still coming out of this game with, those receiver questions and what exactly this group of receivers can give you, especially without Kevin Austin as a rose in that game against Duke.
Yeah, it's understandable. I think that's a normal reaction among anyone. But, if the receivers had caught, 10 passes for 180 yards and the tight ends would have caught one for 6 yards, then right now we'd be talking about, when are they going to incorporate the tight end? It's tough to be really efficient at everything. Right now, their point of emphasis is with the ground attack. And then utilizing the tight ends, and you evolve as it goes on. And the great teams, the ones that are going to be in the playoffs, they're able to incorporate all of that. whether Notre Dame will be one of those type of teams as the season develops, that remains to be seen. And that's understandably the main talking point, as whether that connection with Ian Book and the wide receiving core can become a factor. Because right now, I think that's viewed as an area that might prevent Notre Dame from being in that championship caliber. They're still top 10 caliber, certainly, but been there, done that. That's where Notre Dame's been the last 3 years. The aspiration always is to get to that highest level. So until you do, the areas that you're coming up a little short in are going to be scrutinized and nitpicked on too.
So I don't, yeah, like you said, they don't haven't really tried to emphasize the receivers, but when they have, it's I just still come up thinking, I don't know. I mean, and here's kind of a one thing that really shows you how they're not trying to, but also how things are just kind of off. Right now they're playing two guys at the skill position spots, meaningful snaps that just aren't really giving you anything in the passing game, or really aren't expected to. And that's Brock Wright and Javon McKinley. So in two games, they played 165 combined snaps. They've run 63 routes. On those 63 routes, 5 targets, 1 catch. McKinley's had 4 of those targets. And against Duke, he played 61 snaps, wasn't targeted. So that's a lot of usage for guys who don't have much of a track record of really being a difference maker in the passing game.
With and, the ball in their hands, let's put it that way.
Right, exactly. And even if you started throwing to him more, it's not like you're going to expect him to create yards after the catch like a Chase Claypool could, or Cole Kmet, or somebody like that. And again, it's one of those where, okay, it's you're out there because you're trying to do what they've spent the first 2 games trying to do. I'm curious to see in games where they start to throw it or anything, how much that decreases, or at least the 12 personnel shifts toward Tremble and Meyer, or as Braden Lindsey gets more back into speed and becomes more of a featured target that he's out there. And of course, I'm sure Kevin Austin will cut into these two whenever he comes back. But yeah, right now it's just those are two spots where, all right, you're kind of giving up a lot for an already strained vertical attack, and I don't know that that's something that's necessarily tenable over the course of the entire season. But again, we'll see if that's something they actually try to do. And I guess going off a little bit in this game, here's one thing I didn't love. Joe Wilkins was targeted once. He played, what was it? The snap count wasn't all that high. After the big breakout, he didn't catch a pass. There was the one target was in the end zone there for what would have been a 4-yard touchdown. Ian Book kind of threw it behind him. But yeah, Wilkins, he played 14 snaps. Okay. And some of those were in garbage time when the game was out of hand. You think that, and this is just, I know what they wanted to do in this game, that, all right, you have chemistry to build with Ian Book and his receivers. And here's a guy who didn't get a lot of time with him the previous couple of years because he was hurt, and told us after the USF game that it was about 50-50 in his split of starters reps and not. I think you want to at least try to get a little bit more of getting those two to more time together, and just more any ability to continue to grow if that's going to be something you want to lean on. And we've heard about Wilkins being someone who's flashed in practice and everything. So that was at least, I'll put it as a little surprising to me. But one thing I did like, they went to a lot of play action. Book was 7 for 8, 98 yards. So at least you're coming out of this having thinking, all right, we've found something that if we've got to dial up some shots, this is one way we've been able to do it well, been able to get guys open, draw a defense up and throw over the middle, all that stuff, the play action. It does for you.
Yeah,
and that's been Book's most comfortable spot.
He was especially effective on first down throws early on in the game. you know, we're talking about that identity as a running team, and you sometimes think, okay, run it on first down, run it on second down. Well, the first two series, the first play in the opening drive was the 24-yard pass to Lindsey, and I mean Trimble, and the second play, what the second series, the first play was a 22-yard pass to Lindsey, and both of them set up touchdowns there. So when you're able to do that effectively on first down, now you have the defense somewhat on their heels.
So speaking of defense, let's talk about Notre Dame's. First, one word from our sponsor, Varsity Clubs. Coming to Notre Dame, plan your stay at the Varsity Clubs by Diamond Resorts, decorated with a collection of Notre Dame memorabilia and located just 2 miles east of Notre Dame in the heart of shopping and restaurants. As a special deal for our Blue and Gold podcast listeners, use the promo code ZVISG and you'll receive 15% off your reservation. Varsity Club Suites offer a king bed with Diamond Resorts quality linens and amenities in every room, living area with a clean queen sleeper sofa, flat screen TVs, fully stocked kitchenette, and more. Relax as you lounge by the indoor pool where you can swim indoors and see outdoors through glass walls in a screened room. Play bocce ball or sit by one of the fire pits in the beautiful outdoor courtyard or shoot pool with your friends and enjoy breakfast on us. Book your stay today, www.diamondresortsandhotels.com or call 800-438-2929. Mention promo code ZVISG and receive 15% off your stay at Varsity Clubs. So the defensive number that stood out to me for Notre Dame was USF was 3 of 20 on third and fourth down. And I think it's the 20 standing out as much as the 3, where you're getting into third down a lot because you're just not doing anything on the early downs because they just struggle to move the ball as a whole. And, you know, the tempo that they tried to do early on, I think, kind of hurt them in that because all of a sudden you're stuck here on third and long and they just weren't going to be able to drop back and pass. So you saw some rollouts and draws and QB runs trying to catch them off guard. Really weren't caught off guard. And that's with, you know, three backup guys in there, some of whom were called into action on pretty short order. Like from what Jack Kaiser alluded to us after the game, and at least Lou, this is how I read into it. Maybe you interpreted it a little different. It seemed like, you know, he came into Saturday, only Saturday, I should say, like thinking, yeah, I'm starting. He was on the scout team on Tuesday and Wednesday of practice week. And so it seemed like it wasn't fully clear that both Liu Fau and Shane Simon were going to be unavailable until very late in the week, which makes the performance all the more impressive. I mean, he had 8 tackles, 2 for loss. He was still in there on special teams a little bit, still in there on some of those nickel packages and third downs like he was very briefly against Duke. And it kind of creates an interesting situation. I mean, this is a wrinkle that the position that already had, you know, a lot of focus on and a lot of questions of who's going to be the buck linebacker. And here's an unlikely candidate. So, and it's not like a situation where, okay, you have a established guy unavailable. And I mean, okay, Houston Griffith's not taking Kyle Hamilton's job or anything like that. And I would say the same probably for Clarence Lewis and Tariq Bracy at that field cornerback slot. Bracy's at least a more proven guy, even though, sure, I certainly think Clarence Lewis earned him some snaps on defense after he didn't play any against Duke. But I don't know, Lou, how do you look at this as far as, all right, what do you do now at buck linebacker, just now that you have this extra candidate who played really well?
You just keep playing the guys who are best. You know, it's in today's conference with Brian Kelly, the name Wally Pipp. Of course, for our younger audience, Wally Pipp was a former first baseman for the New York Yankees who one day needed to sit out in the lineup, and they replaced him with a young guy named Lou Gehrig. And 2,130 games later, Lou Gehrig finally sat. And Wally Pipp was a good baseball player, kind of just had to deal with it. So what Kelly was emphasizing is there are a lot of Wally Pipp candidates on this Notre Dame team. There's a lot of competition at a number of spots. And I think the buck linebacker position manifested as well as anyone. the quarterback positions there. There's going to be competition there. Running back, we see it all the time. I mean, the areas that the offensive line, okay, you've got established guys there with 114 career starts. You've got defensive line, virtually all senior and all, but and then a Jeremiah Owusu-Koramoah and Kyle Hamilton, yeah, they're going to stay in the lineup there. But most of the spots there, there's not a broad demarcation of somebody being vastly superior to somebody else. It's really outstanding competition. We've seen it at quarterback through the years. Malik Zaire had a fantastic start in 2015, gets injured in the second game, and Deshaun Kizer becomes a second round pick who had, you know, previously not even played before. So that's what makes, we use that word a lot, program. That's what constitutes a program, is it becomes a plug and play. Not to say that everyone is expendable or not indispensable or whatever else, but one of the points I made on Sunday was, this is best lineup at Notre Dame, roster at Notre Dame, I should say, from 1 through 85 in 30 years, since the halcyon years of Lou Holtz in the early or late 80s and early 90s, where you have just strong roster. Now, the 2005 roster with Brady Quinn, Jeff Samardzija, Ryan Harris, Victor Abiemeri, Trevor Laws, from 1 through 15, that was as, you know, good a lineup as maybe other than three or four teams in the country. The problem was you had really poor recruiting classes in 2003 and 2004. So once you went beyond 15 and 20, it got a little bit thin, so there was a little margin for error. The 2015 team, which probably had the most pure talent in the Brian Kelly era, you saw there, you lose a Malik Zaire and a Deshaun Kizer comes in. You lose a Jerron Jones and a Jerry Tillery, who becomes a future first-round pick, steps in. From 1 through 40, that was also very strong, but I'm talking clear across the board. Now, all the way down to 80. And if there's ever a year you need that, it's this year with the COVID-19 threat.
The timing of it, I mean, of course, just kind of purely coincidental of where it's built to this point. Yeah, it really helps when this probably isn't the last time you're going to have emergency fill-ins needed for guys who were absent, we'll call it. So, but the early return of how do you fare in that first game is about as good as you can ask for. So we'll see what they do at Buck. But if it were me and let's say Simon and Leofau don't play this week against Wake Forest either, it's going to be really hard to take him out of there if he plays well again. And I think it's also at least worth noting, Simon Leofau, like, they beat him out in camp, technically, right? Or otherwise Kizer would have been starting week one. So I think that'll at least speak for something, where when those guys get back, whenever that is, they're not going to be thrown back onto the scout team and not even given a chance again or anything. But certainly something they didn't expect, but a good problem for Clark Lee to have. We haven't talked to him, but I'm thinking he'd be even himself a little surprised at how well this went for a guy who took a redshirt last year and was, yeah, like you said, playing scout team.
But I know Clark Lee was very high on Kizer that freshman year, and they used him on special teams, as they did with Leofau, for four games there. So right away they made an impact. And Brian Kelly went out of his way prior to the season opener against Duke to point out, you know, there's two guys right now on the defensive scout team that we're having a heck of a tough time blocking. And it's become a problem. Jack Kizer was one of them, and J.D. Bertrand, a fellow sophomore linebacker, he plays the Mike position, is another. And this goes back to my 1 through 85. Those are your two third-team linebackers. And the scout team with that veteran line is having problems with them. Now we look at that Mike linebacker position. You have the returning starter in Drew White, and then Bo Bauer, who, you know, would be starting at a lot of Power 5 schools there. And has played quite a bit, seen a lot more reps than he had last year, and is alternating more with Drew White there. And, you know, maybe J.D. Bertrand down the road this year, it's like, who's that guy? And all of a sudden, he has to be inserted, and it's he'll produce as well. But I think there's a great confidence. Look, we're not even talking about the potential fourth guy at Buck linebacker, Osita Ekwonu, who was a four-star recruit. This is what I'm referring to as far as the depth there. And I think it also gives the insight as to why Notre Dame didn't feel compelled that it needed to sign a linebacker in this last recruiting class.
Yeah, I think all the second guessers on, okay, why aren't they recruiting a linebacker in 2020 are pretty quiet, right? Quiet now. And again, it doesn't mean like, okay, you can't still wish they took this player that you really liked in that class, but no, it certainly won't be a death sentence. And that's become pretty clear right now. And I probably even think, they'll be okay with just Prince Kali in 2021 if that ends up being the only guy that they sign. They're not on too many of their linebackers right now. So yeah, you've got to feel good about that position. Cornerback too. I mean, Clarence Lewis, I mean, okay, you could at least expect against a team that wouldn't challenge him vertically like South Florida after the training camp that he had, expect that he'd be able to hold his own, show out, make a few plays. He did. He played a deep ball really well, and probably the one shot that they took on him undercut it. It was really underthrown, but still, those are ones where the receiver can kind of run back into you and draw a cheap PI penalty. He didn't get himself in that position because he was turned around. He undercut, I think this was on fourth down or a third or fourth down. I don't remember exactly, but USF was driving, played an in-cut route well. That's where he dropped really well. It could have been an interception, still made it a great play on the ball. Came up and run support to make a tackle that was initially forced, I believe, by Jeremiah Owusu-Koramoah on, I think it was an option play, where Owusu kind of blew it up and just left the remnants there for Lewis to clean up. So you've got to like that. And then just a quick note, and you probably maybe noticed, Nick McLeod came out a little earlier than normal on Saturday, or at least earlier relative to when the other starters did. They got Cam Hart some work in there. He's fine. He was on the sideline the entire time with his helmet. Just wanted to get Cam Hart more work after he barely played in week one, and McLeod being kind of one of the few proven options at that boundary corner, just kind of an easy opportunity to get one of your younger guys a little bit more time there.
That's what I'm referring to. Again, it's not intended as a disrespect to the opponent, but it was a scrimmage for Notre Dame. This was utilized as a scrimmage, an opportunity to get people in there. I asked Brian Kelly about, Cam Hart received 44 snaps, according to Pro Football Focus, and Nick McLeod only 14. That surprised me a little bit because, I didn't notice the numbers out there as much watching it from the television, since only one is allowed into the press box. But Cam Hart was coming off shoulder surgery. He did not have the spring practice. He was recruited as a wide receiver, but tremendously excited about his potential, his length, that 6'3 type of frame to help at quarterback. You don't see many with that type of length and range. So it's like, look, this is a perfect opportunity to really give him those game time reps. He's not going to be hurt, but just to be out on the field. And this is what I was referring to on last week too, about you don't play Kyle Hamilton in this game. You don't need to. You don't have to. Don't risk, losing your superstar in a game that really, you could put your second team out there and win going away. So it's not worth the risk. And I think that's the way they felt with Nick McLeod too. They're going to need him for the long haul. He needed a lot of work in the preseason because he was coming from a different school. He was not familiar with the Notre Dame system and the workouts and everything. So he had a lot more put on his plate. And this was an ideal opportunity now to let him take a breather and get Cam Hart the reps that they wanted in these game type situations. And he acquitted himself pretty well.
So the scene I'm picturing right now is it's 20, 27 or whenever Notre Dame schedules the return trip to Tampa. That's official, by the way, now after this game was played, they have to schedule those next two games. And they're about to run out in the field, and Jeff Scott plays this clip of us referring to this game as a scrimmage, as look at, they disrespected us, of course, taking a chip off his old boss. Nobody believed in little old Clemson or whatever. But no, you're correct. And
yeah. Well, if Jeff Scott is going to do as well as he hopes to at South Florida, he won't be the coach there in 27. He'll be hired maybe to succeed Dabo or, you know, at a big Power 5 type school.
Yes. The more I think about it, the more you're right. I wonder what even are the odds that, you know, Jeff Scott is coaching by the time Notre Dame plays South Florida again, you know, whenever that happens. We're not going to know those dates for another year.
Who knows? By then, maybe he'll be the flavor of the month to succeed Brian Kelly someday.
How the coaching circle turns. So we will talk to you guys again on Thursday. We will find out if Dave Clawson is using our slights or whatever else as motivation for Wake Forest. No, of course we won't. But anyway, we will preview Wake Forest for you guys. Until then, please rate, review, subscribe to the podcast. Leave us nice comments if you enjoyed what you heard. Subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. If you're watching us on YouTube, hit that thumbs up button. Subscribe to our YouTube channel. Till then, take care.